All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Free For All Live on a Thursday night. Happy to be with you once again. I had taken a week off last week, just too much work catching up to be all at once, but I'm back with a little bit more energy than I usually have because I've had a week's rest, and we have a great show for you tonight, a great topic of conversation. As you can see, I have a guest, Mr. Ken W. Good. I'm going to give a two-line bio on Mr. Good. Ken Good is a highly experienced bail attorney and legal expert based in Tyler, Texas. With over 30 years of practice, he has become a prominent voice in the field of bail reform and criminal justice. He has argued cases before the Supreme Court of Texas, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and numerous courts of other numerous courts of appeals, including the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. His book, Goods on Bail, A Practice Guide for the Bail Industry Professionals. That's really become sort of like, I guess, the Bible for the industry best practices. And he is also a board member of the Professional Bondsmen of Texas. And that way, Ken here has established himself as a leading authority on bail law. So, Ken, welcome to the show. Happy to have you on tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you for the nice things you say. The only thing I would add to it is I'm a father of two girls, so I'm married to a beautiful woman who's also an attorney. And the biggest mistake I made in my life is to marry someone who's a lot smarter than you. you can't get away with anything.
Is that a mistake or is that a plus?
I think it's both.
It's a little bit of both, right? Okay.
I think when you get married, you think it's a benefit. And as you get older, you think, oh, what did I do?
Yeah, I find myself in the same boat as you, Ken. My wife is a scientist, so I have to put up with a microbiologist running the house. But we're two men finding ourselves in the same situation, so hopefully we can commiserate. To all our viewers and listeners out there, if you have a question for Ken or just in general on our topic tonight, feel free to leave your questions on YouTube, Rumble, X, or Facebook. We'll see them, and we'll pop them up on the screen here and address your questions as best we can. All right, so tonight's topic is an issue of interest to libertarians everywhere. And I'm talking about criminal justice reform and bail reform. The two kind of go hand in hand. And Ken being an expert on a little bit of an expert on both subjects, I wanted to bring him on to discuss this. Now, Ken, one of the biggest things that's happened here in recent months is that sort of surreptitiously, very quietly, after hearing the FBI tell us that the crime rate and the number of crimes have been decreasing steadily, they revised their numbers up until the 2022 crime stats, and they revised them upwards. I'm just looking at my notes here. Originally, the FBI had reported a 1.7% decrease in violent crimes from 2021 to 2022. The revised data now shows a 4.9% increase, so a nearly 5% increase in violent crimes during that same period. And specifically, the updated numbers show that there were 1.197 million violent crimes in 2021, and there are now, in 2022, 1.256 million total crimes. So let me ask you this. Do you feel this was an honest mistake, or were there political motivations behind this upward revising? Like, now, look, we're used to government playing games with statistics, right? It applies to the inflation rate. It applies to the unemployment rate. Obviously, job now, data. All the jobs data. You're absolutely right, Ken. And also, in addition to that FBI data, I should also say that the National Crime Victimization Survey, the NCVS, which is a part of DOJ, their numbers are actually a little more severe than the FBI's. They show a higher percentage increase. And if you went back further in time, the NCVS actually shows that it was always on the higher end of the range than the FBI. So, Ken, talk to me. Is crime on the rise in America?
Well, this is a very important issue, especially for people who are starting to vote for president, because the FBI crime statistics is the one argument that once extreme of the political spectrum has been arguing to support their claim that crime is not increasing. So that's the only thing they've been able to point to. I mean, everything else. And, you know, I wrote an article just in the last 2 weeks that was published in Attorney at Law magazine online, and calling into question the FBI statistics, saying, you know, there's other federal agencies that that track crime in different things, and they all contradict the FBI statistics. I mean, the CDC tracks homicide rates. The Department of Justice National Crime Victimization Survey, as you've mentioned, also is something that the federal government's doing for decades, and it shows crime up substantially. I mean, 42% for rape, 63% for robbery, 34% for assault. So, and even, you know, the biggest problem with the FBI statistics is they changed their reporting model 4 or 5 years ago, and it's just been a debacle in converting. And like the two largest criminal police forces in the country weren't even reporting to them, LA and New York. And even scientists, you know, social scientists were saying, well, the department, I mean, the FBI statistics are not accurate. So I did an article just, you know, 2 weeks ago, pulling all this data together. And 9 days after my article was published, lo and behold, it was discovered the FBI had changed their statistics. Now, it wasn't because of my article, but it sure was great timing. I mean, it was almost like they were afraid that Trump was going to win, and they didn't want that to come out after the election. So they wanted to disclose it first. But it's a devastating change in numbers, because the one party running for president, that's the only thing they've been able to hang their hat on for the last 2 or 3 years, saying crime is not increasing. And for that just to now be discovered as completely wrong just kills their argument that crime is not going up, because you cannot say crime is not increasing in the United States, especially in our urban areas. I mean, when the NAACP in Oakland, California, demands a state of emergency on crime, the left cannot say crime is not increasing.
Right. Now, let me ask you this, though, because I always throw this in. I'm a little bit of a pragmatist, so I want to ask you this. Whenever I see something hinky going on with the government, my first reaction as a former conservative and current libertarian is to attribute it to incompetence, not malfeasance. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that this is like you said, I'm a data scientist. So when you change models, when you change reporting methodologies, there's always this that goes on. No matter how much you prepare, no matter how much you test, if I all of a sudden change a methodology but keep the data set the same, there's going to be issues. There's going to be inconsistencies. That's just part of the ball game. So do you feel, and I'm not justifying anybody, I'm just asking for your opinion here, is your sense that this was a purposeful misrepresentation of the data, or do you feel this is just typical government incompetence on the federal level?
You know, somebody gave me some advice one time, and they said, never go to ill intent, just like you said, when incompetence is simple enough to explain it. If it was, and you could even say incompetence here because they've gone to a different model, different ways to report. And I think they even did a press release that didn't even make sense, that kind of said, oh, well, you know, some of this is automated. And so it just was automatically updated, which is consistent with the article I wrote saying it's incomplete data. But then you throw in weeks before an election, it's discovered. And, you know, then the timing becomes suspect. And then you've got all these other overlays of they didn't want it to come out after the election. Mm. And, you know, it was discovered when, you know, suddenly the polls are starting to break in the Republicans' favor. And so, I mean, you could make either conclusion here and you would have evidence to support it, in my opinion.
So, Ken, though, I'm a little confused. Wouldn't this news benefit Republicans, as they're typically viewed as the, whether it's true or not, they're perceived as the law and order party. So wouldn't this revelation, the FBI revising the crime statistics upwards, be a benefit to Trump and a detriment to the Harris campaign?
Oh, absolutely. And it's worse than that, because it completely destroys the only argument that the Democrats have been using for 2 years as to why crime is not increasing in their opinion. And it's been all over the news. I mean, these statistics, these changes just came out in the last week, and it's been all over the news. Trump's campaign did a press release about it saying this just destroys the arguments of the Democrat candidate. So absolutely what you're saying is correct. It helps Republicans, but it's worse than that because it destroys the narrative of the Democrats. But I will say, the Republicans being the law and order party is a new phenomenon. Historically, we've always been, both parties have been law and order. But we're repeating the same cycle that we went through in the 60s, where we felt more safe, we were more forgiving on our criminal laws, and then suddenly crime went up, and then we had a disagreement over how to fight it. And so one party refused to participate, and so nothing passed, and then we had a backlash, and then Reagan was elected with his war on drugs. We're having that same thing happen right now, and I would say the pendulum swung much further to the left this time, for specific reasons, and it will, as a result, it'll swing much further to the right this time when it does. And the only thing that's been keeping it from swinging to the right, I think, in the last election was the issue of abortion. And I don't perceive that abortion is going to prevent the backlash this time because of the immigration issue as well.
Right, right. See, and I'm glad you kind of brought up the sort of a historical context for this, because I was trying to do some quick research and see if this period in time was analogous, say, to the late 60s, the liberalization of justice reform, crime analysis, you know. And that's, you know, people who are just fans of pop culture, you remember like the Dirty Harry movies of the early and mid 70s and the Death Wish series, which was all citizens being fed up with crime and the perception that government wasn't doing anything about it. And that's where you had the vigilantism, the rogue cops in pop culture that came up. And, you know, like, I'm a born and bred New Yorker. I mean, we had our Bernhard Goetz, our subway vigilante, who would, you know, shot
there's
up.
There's another one from New York that's going on trial or in trial right now for being a quote unquote a vigilante. Someone was acting out in public and he stepped in and the guy died. And so they charged him for doing something to protect the public and causing which ultimately caused the death of the perpetrator. But on the issue of crime, I mean, you've got the governor of New York coming out in the last day or two citing statistics saying crime, this is evidence that crime is going down. New York is safer. And there's an article in the New York Post that came out today saying she's quoting statistics that are incomplete and it only covers 20-something% of the state of New York. And all of those counties have Republican DAs. And then it went on and on about the counties that didn't report yet and were controlled by Democratic DAs and how crime was running amok in those counties.
Now, let's put this in context. Crime has gone up, say, since 2020, 2021. I think that's when the recent uptick in crime, you could start tracking it, right? But if you were to look over a 10-year period or a 15-year period, crime really has gone down, right?
Look about what's happened. We've done criminal justice reform and we've done bad bail reform across the country where crime went up substantially. And now you're saying, oh, we're celebrating that it's down some, but it's still up 20% over what it was when we started all these crazy bail reform, criminal justice reform measures across the country or in those, our urban areas.
And those reform measures are about what? Since the pandemic, right? Basically. Is that like a good
Some of them are, you know, like New York passed theirs right at the start of the pandemic and even rolled back part of it the first time during the pandemic because it was so disastrous. And they've now rolled it back two more occasions. So I like to describe the pandemic as where we tried some of these stupid, silly bail reform measures on steroids, and we saw how bad they were. I mean, you know, there's a DA in Yolo County, California, that just he kept all of his data, and he released a study that showed the difference on someone released on a private surety bond versus someone released on simple release, just on their promise they'll come back, that there was a 200% greater chance that the person who was simply released would be rearrested on a violent offense in the next 18 months versus somebody who was released on a private surety bond. I mean, with that kind of statistics, you wonder, why does anyone in the country release anybody on a simple release mechanism where we're just taking their promise? And that's the problem. These bad bail reform measures cause chaos. Chaos causes backlogs. Backlogs causes a pressure to dismiss cases, and dismissal of cases is perceived as a green light to commit more crime. And that's what's happened.
And not that I disagree with you, because I think the cause and effect here is pretty clear, right? We're not just guessing that these reforms have, you know, led to this. I don't disagree with you there. But what's interesting to me is, especially since you bring up, this is like a bifurcated issue, right? Like the first part is, why is crime on the rise, right? That's a general question that I would have, right? Because it's not just the people out on bail or with bail reform specifically. I agree that's an issue down a bit further down. But I mean, why do you think that since 2020, there's just been more violent crime and just more crime in general? I mean, is it being locked up with the pandemic? Like, so bad?
No. These are interconnected issues. I mean, you have to, so, you know, the difference release mechanisms, you know, like the private surety bail system. I mean, it is, you know, when you get released from jail, it is what assurance you're going to give the court that you're going to come back. And, you know, if it's a simple release mechanism, in New York, we call it release with no bail. In California, we call it release on zero bail. In Texas, we'd call it release on a personal bond. But they're all the same thing. You're released on your promise. And the court doesn't need anything else but your promise to come back. And here's the problem. Criminal cases are very different. The case can't go forward if you fail to appear, except for in very limited situations. So, like, you know, I did a podcast with the Yolo County DA. He says these simple release mechanisms are used in California across the state for misdemeanors. They have an 80% failure to appear rate. Harris County, Houston, Texas, is using simple release for most misdemeanors and has an 80% failure to appear rate, according to HarrisCountyCourtWatch.com. And, you know, 80% failure to appear rate, you can't get anything done. And compared to the private industry, which has a less than 10% failure to appear rate, I mean, that's not comparable. In fact, a former judge even said on a News Nation town hall that until you have an alternative that has the same level of accountability and the same high appearance rate, you don't have an alternative. And that's is what I'm saying when it creates chaos. If you have an 80% failure to appear rate in California misdemeanor court, you overlay on top of that the Speedy Trial Act. Well, if they don't come back within a certain period of time, you have to dismiss their case. Well, and then we have these crazy DAs who've decided in California, we're not going to prosecute theft under $950 anymore because, you know, these people are just trying to make it. No, organized crime gangs and career criminals have figured out ways to make millions of dollars out of this because suddenly stores are getting shoplifting $25,000 a day. They can't withstand that. So they're closing their buildings or their shops. And then the next thing is you have commercial properties dropping in value. You've got buildings selling for 30 to 50% of what they sold for 2 or 3 years ago. In Minneapolis, you had two buildings recently sell for 9% of what they sold for last time. Default rate on commercial properties has gone up from 5% to it's currently 41% and rising. So all these things are interconnected. If you cannot provide public safety or you're giving up on public safety like misdemeanors, well, then who's going to be shocked when crime increases? Who's going to be shocked when you suddenly decide you're not going to prosecute anymore? Or if they don't come, you're not going to do anything to them. Well, of course, you start dismissing cases like that because you have a time limit and you aren't going to force them to come back. They have to come back on their own. Well, then, of course, criminals are going to see that as a green light to commit more crime.
Well, I've got a lot of issues with the criminal justice system as a libertarian and with policing in general, no doubt about it. But at the same time, from a behavioral point of view, yeah, you're not going to get rid of a bad behavior by not providing consequences against it. So I
well, understand I'd love to have your opinion on the Portland experiment that we've just been engaging in, or the Oregon experiment we've been engaging in for several years, where we've decriminalized all hard drugs. And it was with the promise that once we decriminalize, then all these people are going to want to go to therapy and, you know, to go to rehab. And instead we went from drug rate of 6% to 12%. We were setting record overdoses every month. I felt we were giving up on a generation, and it was such a bad experiment, which libertarians would say was their goal, but it was such a bad experiment. We let the statutes lapse and they weren't renewed.
Yeah. Well, that's a different type of thing, right? Like, so I'm pro drug legalization, even though personally, I don't even drink. I don't even take any over-the-counter medication unless absolutely necessary. I am not the poster child for legalization of drugs from my personal behavior, but I do believe that. Now, I do have a distinction though. Like, whereas I think drugs should be decriminalized and let individuals deal with their own consequences, I do draw the line if, you know, it leads to robbery, theft, assault, murder. All these things are still crimes. And I would not have an excuse under the law or mitigating circumstances that says, well, I was high or I was addicted, right? It would still be a crime, in my opinion. The issue, though, is like the thing with bail for me, it puts me in a tough ideological space, right? Because if you haven't been convicted of a crime, why should you be incarcerated? Just as a general principle, right?
But this concept dates back to the Magna Carta. It's
no, I don't disagree with
you. Us from England. I mean, this right, the government has a right to hold you to answer for your charges. It doesn't have anything to do with guilt or innocence. Bail is what assurance you're going to give that you're going to come back. And so, I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with guilt or innocence. We hear that all the time. Oh, well, they have a presumption of innocence. What are they doing in jail? It's about what assurance that you're going to give that you're going to come back.
No, and that's what I wanted to sort of work out with you right now, because I agree. I don't have the easy solution for this, but I wanted to discuss it with you, which is, you know, when you hear things like cash bail, and forgive me, I'm not familiar with the separate degrees of bail that you're talking about, so correct me on the technical language, please.
I would use the language private surety bail, because cash bail can be a cash bond, and that's used interchangeably, and so it means two different – it doesn't mean what people intend it to mean. So I would just say the private industry bail system.
Okay, so private industry bail, which means that I have to either put up a certain percentage – correct me again.
I have
to
premium.
At a premium, pay a certain percentage that increases the likelihood that if I want to get my money back, especially if I'm innocent, I have to show up to court. And when I do show up to court, that bond is then released, right? And you get at a premium, right? Now, of course, the criticism there is that if someone who is not of means is arrested, that there's no private bail available to them, private surety bail, or cash bail for them to say, okay, you know, if it's a $100,000 bond, you know, you got to come up with, what is it usually, 10 grand, 20 grand on the 100? Say
10%.
10%, right? Look, especially in urban areas, especially some of the poorer areas of this country, someone may not have 10,000.
Yeah, but I mean, here's the problem I have with that is this argument, which we hear all the time, assumes that we have a cookie cutter criminal justice system, and that's just not what we have. The criminal justice system is intended to only apply the minimum amount of pressure on you, the defendant, that will cause you to change and become a productive citizen. And so if, you know, a first time offender, I just don't believe a first time offender is held anywhere in this country anymore. Because, you know, your ability to pay bail is one of the factors in Texas that they have to consider. And so if you're a first time offender, you're not held. I bet you're just released with either a personal bond or a very, very low bond. I mean, can you imagine a $500 bond? You pay 10%. They even give you a payment plan for that. But here's the problem we have. After you have a criminal record or you've been arrested multiple times, then now, in my opinion, if you are bail is set for you and it's now set higher because of your criminal record, you're not in jail because you can't afford the bond. You're in jail because you have a substantial criminal record and public safety demands it. And I don't have a problem with that. And you know what? The courts have ruled that they don't have a problem with it. The problem that we have is these activists who are pushing these reforms, they have a problem with it. And they start out by arguing it's unconstitutional to do that. Well, now we've had the 10th Circuit and the 5th Circuit say, no, that is constitutional. And the U.S. Supreme Court has denied a petition for cert in at least 5 times on their cases, refusing to address or even talk about those issues because they feel like they're settled. And so I just think that the argument of, well, if you don't have money or it favors somebody who has money, no matter what, they can get out. All those things are supposed to be taken into consideration on an individual basis. If I'm a man of means, my bond is going to be higher than a person who doesn't have means, especially as a first-time offender.
I agree with what you're saying. But you tell me, does, and I mean, look, especially when it comes to recidivists, I 100%, right? Like, at some point, logic cannot be overcome by hypothesis, right? Like we see the empirical evidence. I'm more than willing to accept that. Someone who's been, you know, he's on his 8th assault rap. Yes, let's give him, he has to provide a higher bond.
Or even better, what if he failed, or he or she, or it for that matter, fails to appear for court 5, 6, 7 times in the same case.
Agreed.
If they fail to show up, then the court should hold them accountable. But agreed, that's not happening in these areas where these bad bail reforms. I mean, we've got examples in Harris County where someone failed to show up 15, 16, 17 times, and they're just released again.
Yeah. No, I see those cases, you're not going to get an argument from me, like, because part of libertarianism is personal accountability. So yes, you're, if you've got a long rap sheet, you're here on the same thing, you know, or even worse, you're a repeat offender, alleged offender, and you've in the past failed to show up. Yes, I think you forfeited leeway.
My perception where you and I differ on drug charges is I think you have to have the hammer of the criminal penalty so that you can get the defendant to agree to go to rehab. And you have to have that over and over because rehab for drug cases has a 75% failure rate. So mm-hmm. you have to have that hammer to convince them to go back to rehab multiple times until they decide, because it's not going to go into effect until they make the decision they want to fight it. And I mean, I think the lesson of Portland and Oregon is if you don't have that hammer, nobody will do it. And I mean, we end up just working every night to bring people back to life so they can go back to their drug dealer the next day. That's not a life and that's not a society.
Yeah, look, it's not a life that I would want for myself or anybody that I care about. But at the end of the day, I still believe in making your own decisions and then living by those decisions.
Okay, let me take your argument to the extreme, because I've heard the argument. People taking that position, then they say, well, these people have a right to commit an overdose if they want. I don't think they do have that right. As a society, we don't want to give them that right. And I don't think the police should be spending every night bringing people back with Narcan. That's not our reaction to giving them the right to overdose. We as a society have to fight that. And you know, going back to the bigger drug issue, I read an article one time that said 80% of all crime can be traced back in one way or another to drugs. So if we give up on drug crimes, we're, in my opinion, we're giving up on crime.
Well, again, I am not anti-prosecution of crimes committed out, even if they are due to drugs. Like, again, I would not allow any mitigation of the crime. But the same way, like alcohol, see, the taking of the drugs itself is what I object to as being the criminal offense. Now, if the criminal offense is driving under the influence and hitting someone, killing someone, committing vehicular homicide, whatever, absolutely. I have no sympathy for anybody, whether it's drugs or alcohol or anything or sleeping, driving while sleep deprived, even. These are all personal choices. I just think that there's a lot of so-called vice crimes that end up perpetuating and making things worse in the criminal justice system. Nonviolent offenders, you know, like, again, I would, if anybody asked for my help, I'd gladly give it to them. I don't think it's the state's, any, this is just where we're going to differ, because I think, you know, and that's fair enough. I mean, I respect your opinion wholeheartedly. And I grew up in some of the worst drug infested neighborhoods in New York in the 70s. So I've seen with my own eyes, and I've experienced friends and people who have lived through this. Some of them didn't live through it. I've experienced it. And I used to be very anti-drug and very pro war on drugs. And then I just came to the realization that it was making things worse, not better. But different argument for a different show, I guess.
You know, I also have a personal story on that. I have a sister who had a car accident in 1989 and broke every bone in her face, and she had started a 30-year prescription drug addiction. Yeah. And I remember fighting very hard trying to get her in prison, really, because at the time when I was a young attorney, prison was the poor man's drug rehab. Yes. And I tried everything that I could, and she had means, and so she was able to escape every freaking time. And it wasn't until late in her life, where she was still just a complete zombie, where I was able to get her and have her declared incompetent, and then get her into an assisted living facility where they monitored her drugs. And her last 5 years, I mean, she had brain damage, and she was slowly getting, you know, more, I mean, she was losing brain cells. Yeah. And so, but her last 5 years ended up being some of the best of the last 30 years, because someone was monitoring her drugs for her, and she could not overdose, and she could not get, you know, these narcotics. I wouldn't approve her to get narcotics.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have made it so there's not a poor man's drug rehab anymore. Because you're made it so we don't hold drugs, people on drugs anymore. And we don't even, we kick them out before they're even, you know, come down from their high. And I think that is a huge mistake. We do not have the room in rehabs to send poor people. We don't have the resources for the states to apply it. So we're killing a generation, in my opinion, because we're not, because of these bad bail reform policies. We're taking away the poor man's drug rehab, and we're not replacing it with anything.
Well, I'm certainly sad to hear about your sister's story that you just related, and it's terrible, obviously. But I don't know. Again, I don't know that setting up a war on drugs with all the cost in lives and resources and efforts makes it any better. I'm not.
Okay, so let's compare the war, the period of time you're thinking about, to war on drugs, and let's compare it to today. Are we worse off today than we were then? I would argue that at the height of the war on drugs, we're better off then than we are right now. I mean, look at California, that's decriminalized marijuana, and they have this legal drug trade that is really in the process of collapsing. And in its place, you've got cartels moving into California and taking over, you know, federal properties, you know, out in the woods. And I mean, they're not just bringing their drugs, they're growing their drugs in the United States. And because of our immigration policies, they're bringing their employees with them, and they're not even scared anymore because we've decriminalized marijuana. So what are you going to do to them for growing something that we've decriminalized? I mean, we're setting it up where the organized crime gangs, cartels, they're figuring out ways to make millions, and the legal trade is collapsing. And then we ended up spending all the taxes from it to try to eradicate the illegal activities. And we can't even talk about it. I mean, I saw a story, someone posted it on Facebook, and it was immediately deleted because it was, you know, outside of the bounds because we have an election coming up.
Well, that type of censorship is another issue entirely. So I don't, you know, I'm not pro shutting it down. But like I said, I just think I'm not convinced, and I think it's a full circle, because like I said, I started out being very, very anti-drug, and in my personal life, I am very anti-drug, recreationally especially, as I am alcohol and tobacco as well. Like, I don't partake of any of that stuff. So, but I try to temper that. Not everybody wants to live the way I do, and I don't know. As a matter of fact, I am of the belief that it's not society or government's role to decide how I should live my life. It is their role to make sure I don't impact anybody else's life against their will. So like, to the extent that if I rob to get high, if I murder to get high, if I assault to get high, it's not the drugs that are the crime, it's the assault, murder, and theft, right? So that's the way I would approach it. But
approach it differently. I would say that we have standards as a society that we want people to not do drugs. We don't want them, and we don't want them to, you know, hurt people on drugs. We don't want them to steal to get drugs, and we just don't want the drugs. I mean, there's a reason why we have so many people in prison. It's because all the other countries in the world send their drugs here. I mean, there is a quid pro quo. I mean, you send all your illegal drugs to the United States, that's going to have an impact on prisons, and it has.
Well, and the argument could be made is that they're illegal because we've just decided they're illegal.
Yeah, but I mean, we've already talked about, I mean, Portland is a great example of that. Here, there's the consequences if we just now say, okay, we're going to wave our magic wand and it's no longer illegal. Okay, great. Now we've got people lining up. It doubled over however many years it was in effect, from 6% to 12%, lining up every day for their drug dealer. So really, what's the police there? They're there to protect the drug dealer to come by every day to get his little payments so that they get their little fix. I mean, all they're doing is spending all day to try to figure out a way to get their whatever amount they need to get their next fix. I mean, that's not a society. And it also, you know, if 80% of all crime is tracked back to that, then we know where the criminals are. And it's the same group all the time. And, you know, the police are just, you know, under your model, they're arresting everybody and releasing them, arresting them and releasing them. And that's what we're doing in our urban areas. And that's why crime is increasing.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say release them if, again, like the way you explain bail, I'm willing to accept, you know, that each crime is a crime unto itself. Each case is a case unto itself. And if the judge sits back and says, like, hey, this guy's a high flight risk, mm-hmm. or this gal's a high flight risk, she's a recidivist. She's a foreign national. She could easily skip the country and not come back. I have to take the passport. I get it. Put up $1 million bond. I'm fine with that. If the other side of the coin is also legitimate, which you mentioned, like you're a first time offender, you don't have means, you know, it's a misdemeanor.
But here's what these really bad bail reform measures are doing. So like in New York and California, they're just making a list of crimes. And they're saying, for these crimes, we are tying the hands of the judges behind their back. They have no discretion. So no matter how many times this crime is committed, you have to release them on a simple release mechanism. So, and that's the problem, is we've got organized crime gangs and career criminals stepping into that void and figuring out we can make millions of dollars. I mean, the best example is the catalytic converter. I mean, you know, like in Harris County in Houston, they kind of quit prosecuting that because, you know, it's a low level crime, but you know, these organized groups can get thousands of dollars off of one catalytic converter. I mean, there's a story from Facebook where two guys were arrested and the police were driving them to the jail for a catalytic converter theft. And they were like, well, this isn't the way to the Harris County jail. And they're like, oh yeah, I know, because you made a mistake and you crossed into Montgomery County, and mm-hmm. we're taking you to the Montgomery County jail and we prosecute catalytic converter theft. And suddenly they were very upset that they didn't stay within Harris County. So these groups know where they're not prosecuting these crimes anymore. And we are creating we're enabling the very situations that we're saying, why is crime going up? That's the reason why our politicians are having to argue, oh, crime's not going up. Just look at the FBI statistics.
I was going to say they've all become street corner lawyers, basically. Yeah. Make sure you stay in one county versus the other one and everything. Yeah. 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 No, that makes sense. Okay. We've got a couple of comments here. William says, California City threatened to fine Target store for reporting thefts, which is interesting. He goes on to say, they not only protected the criminals with this new law, they threatened a store for reporting thefts. Okay.
I remember when that law went into effect, because it was really, that's exactly what it was. We do not want y'all reporting these thefts, and we don't want you to do anything about it. And all kinds of penalties in it if the store violated it. So, I mean, why would they be surprised that stores would say, we're leaving because you don't even value us? So why would we continue to say pay property taxes or tax, sales taxes and give it to right. our government when they don't even care about us.
Right, right. And then the final comment from William, if Target didn't stop calling 911, the city office warned it would hit the retailer with an administrative fine, a source told the Sacramento Bee. So there you have it. Like, you know, you're saying they're like, we can't even report crime. Now, that to me is a different issue, right? Because that is a political issue that because there is a crime being committed, theft, or I'm assuming theft in the but case of Target,
you
right?
How bad the crime is, because now they're encouraging people not to report it. And now you see if do-gooders step in, they're going to prosecute them because they want to send the message to the public. You will not step in. And, you know, we've even had some governments tell their local official, you know, local citizens, if someone breaks in your house, just give them what they want. Is that, I mean, that's really telling criminals, we're telling everybody you've got a free pass. So go do whatever you want. That can't be the message that we are sending our community. And that's not even a message for a society to survive. I mean, Mayor Adams in New York, he's got a lot of problems right now, but he said on a podcast recently that one of the foundations of society is public safety. And if you can't provide public safety, you don't have a society.
Well, yeah. And listen, that's even the libertarian principle. Like, to the extent that a libertarian believes in government at all, that one of the few legitimate functions of government is to protect the rights of each and every citizen, including from other citizens. So yes, things like theft, murder, assault, all, even in a libertarian utopia, if there does exist a government, that is the reason why it should exist. But I agree with you on that.
You see all these illogical arguments. You know, the same people arguing that we should decriminalize these things, or we should not prosecute, or we should not hold anybody accountable, they're also arguing that we shouldn't have guns. And so, you know, we're not going to provide you with public safety, and we're not even going to give you the means to protect yourself. I mean, my response to that is, good God, please have some common sense. If you can't provide me with public safety, at least give me the ability and the means so that I can protect myself and my family. Good God, please.
Yeah. Well, Ken, you and I are in alignment on that. Obviously, you know, the ability to protect yourself and to have a weapon if you want to bear arms or whatever. Certainly, 100% aligned with you on that. But to the issue of bail reform specifically, you mentioned New York. We've mentioned California. What was the situation prior to the current bail situation? So like in New York, right? We all heard the stories. Guys with violent crimes being let go with little to no bail. And they're out on their own recognizance. They're out on their own, you know.
What was driving the reform?
I was going to say,
in New York was people were dying in the county jail. So like Rikers Island, people were dying. And so the activist groups were using that as a grounds to say, we need these reforms because this guy was in jail. He should not have been in jail. And we need to tie the hands of the judges so they can't hold them in jail. And that was probably the impetus for this argument. And it gets even worse. You know, you've got politicians talking about closing Rikers Island and not replacing really the bed space or the capacity. And so that's a backdoor push to force bail reform because you don't have anywhere to put them. I mean, that's really what happened in California. The state prison system was capped by a 3-judge panel and at 124% of their capacity. And so everything that's been done in California, they can call it whatever they want. They can say, we're going to release more criminals and that's going to make you safer. It's all a lie because the whole purpose of everything that's taking place in California is just to reduce the state prison population. They've moved people from the state to the counties and they've quit prosecuting crimes and they're still right at capacity on the state system. They just need to build more freaking capacity in California.
So while I understand what you're saying and given a certain set of constructs, I agree with what you're saying, like that this bail reform, and I'm using air quotes for reform in, say, New York. Now, when you say people were dying at Rikers Island, you're referring to COVID?
You're always going to have people. I mean, you've got really dangerous people in the jail, and sometimes you don't have things happen.
Right.
People have fights. And when you're there with really dangerous people, they're going to have consequences. I mean, it's a sympathetic argument when somebody dies in prison. But I would say the steps we've taken to address it has jeopardized public safety. It turned out not to be the correct argument or the correct remedy.
Okay, so I'm just trying to encapsulate to summarize what you're saying. So you had this issue where people were dying in Rikers Island in New York for various reasons, getting mixed up with the wrong crowd, being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It happens, and then the activists use that as a push for change.
So that resulted in change, and I do believe hearing that when COVID first hit, they also didn't want too big of a prison population unless absolutely necessary to prevent people from catching COVID in prison, right?
What I think COVID did was, you know, all these little screwy, crazy ideas for simple release had been going around as arguments, but because of COVID, when we wanted to get rid, lower the jail populations, we took out these terrible things that have no science said they would work and said, let's use these. It's kind of like, under Obama, his chief of staff's like, never let, a bad situation go to waste.
Never let a crisis go to waste. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they dusted all these things off and they pulled them out and used them. And that's how we got a whole bunch of data showing they don't work. I mean, I would say, but for COVID and New York, we would probably be a lot further down the bad bail reform train than we are, because all the bad consequences of New York have stopped that from happening.
Interesting. So right now, you talked about a pendulum before, right? So when the liberals kind of get their ideas in place, it swings to the left. And then things don't work out the way they want, so the pendulum swings over to the right, and then again you have negative consequences because of that, or unintended consequences. So now the pendulum swings. Okay, so we never seem to sit in the middle here on reasonable solutions. Mm-hmm. At this point, what would Ken Good's solution? What would a proposal be for reasonable bail reform that would address both the crime issue, the recidivism issues, and also the concerns of, like we've talked about, particular groups being harder hit by certain bail requirements, people with low, like nonviolent crimes being held possibly longer than they should. What would be a good solution that addresses both, if we use broad strokes, the left's concerns and the right's concerns on bail reform?
Well, this is one of those very rare situations where I don't know if there is a compromise, because we can't even agree whether crime is increasing at the moment. I mean, we started by talking about the FBI statistics and how for 2 years or more or 3 years or more, the left has used them as, no, crime is not increasing. Look, here's the FBI statistics. Now we know that's all a lie. And even as of yesterday or today, the governor of New York is using other statistics to take their place to say crime is down. And we're having to have articles in the New York Post saying that it's incomplete data. It's only 20-something% of the state and or population of the state. And she knows it. And so it's really difficult to find a compromise when we have one side of the argument that won't even agree that there's a problem with the reforms they've done. So, I mean, but there is a fix. I mean, we know how to fight crime. I mean, we teach this in our criminology in our colleges. We don't teach all of these simple release mechanisms as alternatives to the private surety bail system, because they're not tested. They don't work. We found out during COVID. And the consequences are really bad. Stick with me just for a moment. If we do simple release and we just have a 50% failure to appear rate. Well, if that's what we're going to switch to, the criminal justice system is a conveyor belt. It's having the same number of cases added to it on average every day, every week, every month. And so anything that slows it down creates backlog after backlog after backlog. So a 50% failure to appear rate every week means you're going to have double the number of courts you currently have just to handle and resolve the exact same number of cases that
just
you
to keep
resolving
pace
before the reform.
Right. Just to keep pace. Yeah. You're going to have to double capacity.
You can't afford that. The state governments can't afford that. So we're doing something that doesn't work, that's creating huge backlogs, which we've already talked about all the things that it does and the pressures it does. So we know what we need to do. The question is, do we have the backbone to do it? We need accountability. So if you want to let somebody go, first time offender, you want to give them a low bond or no bond, fine. But what's the accountability? The problem is we've tied the hands of judges. We've got to untie them and give them their discretion so that if you don't show up for court, you can be held accountable, because we got to get cases resolved. I mean, I don't think people realize that all these simple release mechanisms, all they've done is slow down the resolution of cases.
Right.
And made it so judges can't resolve cases, which then puts pressure to dismiss the case, like we know in California under the Speedy Trial Act. And dismissal is de facto decriminalization, and that is a green light to commit more crime. We have to change that. We do have a case that gives us the roadmap to fix this. It's called Sanchez versus Alabama. They lived under one of these crazy temporary injunctions for 4 years. And it wasn't just misdemeanors. It was misdemeanors and felonies. And while the case was on appeal, they were ordered not to hold anybody. They couldn't hold anybody accountable. They just had to keep releasing it. And right. Crime started going up. Well, it got reversed and they won. And I did a podcast with the sheriff and he said it took us a little bit of time, but we went back and we implemented a system of accountability, and we let criminals know that if you didn't show up for court, you'd be held accountable and there'd be consequences. And what do you know, within about 6 months, crime started going down.
Yeah. And you know, despite my libertarian tendencies popping up again, I am not for the dismissal or delay of justice, right? Mm-hmm. So I have no issue with that. I am just as concerned about if my wife is walking on the street that I can expect her to get to her destination without being assaulted. Yeah,
that's right.
We share that 100%. I'm just wondering how much of that court backlog can be reduced by eliminating victimless crimes, or sometimes they're called
vice crimes. I do think that's a good point. I think we should all do a review of all of our criminal laws and see, do we really want this to be a crime anymore? But the problem we have is, without doing that, we have one county is enforcing laws that the very next county is not. And that undermines the credibility of our criminal justice system. It really does.
But it does almost like... I understand the concern, and I understand how clever criminals can navigate that to their advantage. But at the same time, part of me is like, well, is that a free market response, sort of? You know, like when we say we leave things to states as opposed to the pecking order is prefer. But it becomes
a very political issue.
Yes, I agree. It becomes political.
And I would say, even to this point now, we know that it gets to the point where you're only prosecuting your political opponents, I believe. I think that one conclusion of Trump's problems is political prosecution. People have forgotten that with the filibuster, you know, that forced compromise between the parties. And so that's the reason why we had a lot of moderates, because moderates were the ones that came up with the ideas that were between the two extremes. As we phased out and got rid of the filibuster, we've gotten rid of moderates, and we now just have the extremes. I mean, I remember a much friendlier time when people were nice during debates, but also, you know, you would pass something that was a compromise and both parties supported it. And so it never got undone. And that was a stepped approach. Now we don't do that. So the first year of an election is spent undoing everything that was done by the last party. And I've never seen that before until the last 10 or 20, 10 or 15 years.
I agree with you. Like, those of us old enough to remember that if Tip O'Neill could sit with Ronald Reagan over a beer in some Washington, D.C. dive and come to accommodations. And I think the basic difference between then and now is that you disagreed with your opponent. You never thought your opponent was evil. And what I think it's
worse than that, though. Worse, you can't raise the money you need to campaign for a party unless you raise it from a certain group. And for that group to give you money, you have to take certain positions. The best example of that is Texas. We've already talked about Texas has always been a conservative state. But now Republicans win the state almost all the time by 13 points, except if your name is Ted Cruz. He usually wins by 3 to 5. He'll probably win 5 to 7 this time, even though everybody's saying he may lose. But the problem is for you to be a Democrat in statewide office, you have to raise money. And to do that, you have to take positions that will then disqualify you from winning in the statewide race in Texas, because Texas is a conservative state. There's just nothing about it. Texas is a conservative state. And so it's very difficult for a statewide Democrat to raise the money needed and take the position they have to do that and then be able to win the election. And you're seeing that with Allred right now. I mean, he's trying to get across the finish line on the abortion issue, but his positions that he's taken on, women in sports and immigration and his comments at the time that he would go personally tear down the wall, I think will probably have a bigger impact. But we'll see in days, in a little bit over 2 weeks.
And I was going to say the same thing applied to New York. It's basically a liberal state. And even if you ran as a Republican, you got guys like Mayor Bloomberg, who in any other definition is at best a left-leaning Democrat or a blue dog Democrat.
Yeah, but look at New York. The only reason why the Republicans control the House right now is because of New York. Upstate New York and crime. And so I think that will happen again. I mean, I don't believe it was an accident that the Republican governor of New York was out today or yesterday misquoting or misleading the public on crime statistics in New York.
Oh, you mean the Democratic governor?
Hochul, because crime is still a huge issue in New York, and it will have just as big of an impact on this election as it did last time.
Especially in the city. I think in the city, while we've been talking, I've been trying to think of my Latin so I can ask you. So I guess we want to keep the malum in se crimes, and in my opinion, get rid of the malum prohibitum. Did I get that right, or did I? I always confuse the two. Ken, did I get those right? You're the lawyer here. You tell me.
Okay, you're talking to a kid who came from a town of 1,254 people that was a farming town, who grew up moving pipe in the peanut field, who went to college, didn't get into law school the first time, then went to law school and just blossomed and loved law school, was on Law Review, was on some national teams, had a best presentation, blah, 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 blah. But I used to teach Spanish in high school, and I don't even know if I could tell you what that meant in Spanish, but I sure as hell can't tell you what it meant in Latin.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was one of those I was put through ancient Greek and Latin as a child, so I don't know how much of it I retain, but to the extent – malum in se, I think, is wrong in and of – the translation would be wrong in and of itself. So – murder would be malum in se. It's wrong in any culture, any society, any time period. Murder is bad. Malum prohibitum would be like helmet laws. It's only wrong because we've said it's wrong. There's nothing inherently wrong about not wearing a helmet.
Shouldn't we as a society say drugs is the first one, not the second one?
I think this is one of those things we're not going to resolve here. It's sort of like what you said about that pendulum, right? I always tell this story. When I was younger and a conservative, one of the 10 in New York that you could count on both hands, right? I used to have I was sort of like a pen pal with William F. Buckley. And one time I asked him about that. I said, shouldn't we toughen up on drug laws and the punishment for drug offenders? And he wrote back to me and he said, John, I'll tell you something. And I always tell my friends, this is so Buckleyan, right? He says, I took my yacht outside the 3-mile limit. I smoked marijuana, tried it to see the effect on me. And then I got back within the 3-mile limit. So he did it legally, right? That was the point he was making. And he said he came to the conclusion that the drug war was a waste of money, resources, and efforts.
Well, I think the last 10 years have proven that to be not correct in my opinion.
Okay. And listen, we can differ,
but I think we're worse off today than we were during the height of the war on drugs.
Yeah, and you know what it is also? I also remember the height of the war on drugs growing up in the Bronx in the 70s. And that's where there were like 10 junkies on every corner and somebody having a knife fight over it. And
yeah, but you know what we don't realize is which segment of society is going to get hurt the worst when crime increases, who gets hurt worse? It's our poor. Minority communities.
Yeah, the minorities, the poor, the economically disadvantaged.
Crime goes up quicker there because that's where. So, I mean, think of this statistic: 50% of all murder victims in the United States are young Black males, and by and large, their murderers are young Black males. Somewhere in this bad bail reform, bad criminal justice reform discussion, we've decided to favor the murderer over the victim.
That's incorrect. You're absolutely right. The victim should have the precedence and the victim's family should have the precedence there. All right. Ken W. Good. What a great show. I thought, and I throw the W in there to give you the impression of a great lawyer, but that's also your name as well. But Ken, thank you for joining the program. I hope we've made a friend that can come on and talk to us about legal issues in the future and crime reform. Ken, please, if you have any podcasts or handles or websites to promote, please let the people know.
Sure. If you want more information about us, you can go to our website, pbtx.com. We have a blog where we highlight important criminal justice stories in the news. And we also have our own podcast, which is called The Bell Post. You can go to the podcast on the menu, or you can just go to thebellpost.com directly. And all we do we highlight criminal justice issues, and we want to educate the public and legislators on these different things that we hear in the news. So like, if you want to know what the New Jersey plan is, we have an episode about it. Cause you know, our side of the story of what works and what doesn't work, I don't think it's covered. I think what we hear all the time is misinformation. Oh, we're going to cook the books and make it look like Illinois is really being successful on their getting rid of cash bonds, even though they got rid of the private industry years before that. And we're misleading the public to they're really getting rid of private surety bonds right now. And it's just all misleading and inaccurate. But for, I think, us and a few other groups, you wouldn't even know the other side of the story.
All right, Ken, thank you so much again for joining us. Everyone, check out Ken's podcast and join us again next week when we'll have another interesting episode of Free for All. And looking ahead to election night, I'm going to have special guest, the vice presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, our good friend Mike Tremont, will be here live with election night coverage. So keep an eye out for that. Until then, thank you, Ken, for joining us once again. This has been your host, Big John. Peace, everyone.